I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up later in the program, we are going to head to East Africa to find out why Somalia is seeing a dramatic rise in sexual abuse cases against women and girls. That's in a few minutes. But we are going to focus most of the program today by talking about money, why we spend what we spend and what we spend it on, and on a personal level, if we're in a mood to make changes, how you can do that. But we want to start here at home, literally, to take note that this country's once hot housing market has now been in a deep freeze for almost exactly 5 years now. And as 2012 begins, some economists say the housing sector may finally be ready for a turnaround. Some expect housing prices to stabilize, but others say a new normal is emerging, a long period when housing prices will remain far below where they were before 2007. So on the occasion of this five-year anniversary, more or less, of the downturn, we thought it was a good time to check in with NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giwax. Marilyn, welcome back. Happy New Year to you.
Hi, thank you. You too.
Now, there's been a lot of talk that the worst is over, that the market has hit its bottom, and that prices are going to stabilize in 2012. Is that just wishful thinking, or is that a distinct possibility?
It is a possibility. Now, let's be clear. We're not talking about going back to 2004 with the flip this house mentality and soaring prices. But it is possible that 2012 could be a better year, and there are several reasons for this. For one thing, affordability. Prices are way down from what they had been. Interest rates are really at historic lows. In our lifetime, Michelle, there hasn't been you've never seen mortgage rates this low. You have to go back to the Depression for that. So there is also a kind of a pent-up demand. People haven't been buying houses for 5 years. So if you've got cheap mortgages, cheap housing prices, people who are looking – that's a good combination. And also, there's another thing. Rents are very high these days. If you've gone out to rent an apartment, you know that maybe buying a house is a better option. And finally, we haven't really had new houses being built in any significant numbers for years now, since 2006. So you might see some builders out there putting new houses on the market, and that'll catch your eye.
You know, we reached out to fans on Facebook to put some real stories to these market trends that you've been telling us about. We got some 500 comments, which is not bad, given that it's the kind of topic where often a lot of people don't really want to put their business out there in the street. And we're going to hear from a couple of them. The first is Adam Clements. He lives in Detroit, Michigan. And to the point that you were making about how rental costs are high enough that buying a house is attractive again, let's listen to what he had to say.
I'm Adam Clements. I'm originally from Wausau, Wisconsin, and I plan on being a first-time home buyer this spring after I graduate medical school. Even though I'll only be in one place for 3 years, I found out that buying a house and paying house payments is even cheaper than paying for rent. And when you buy a house, it allows you to keep the money in the form of equity rather than just handing it to somebody else. And the only possible issue is being able to resell the property in 3 years after residency is over and I'm likely to move or upgrade to a different house.
Well, Adam, we appreciate you writing, but that whole keep the equity is a that's the point. That's supposed to be the point, Marilyn. But
well, he is certainly the person that realtors are hoping to see all over the country this year, that they're sort of tired of renting. They're eager to buy. They see that prices are pretty good and the rents are pretty high. But he has something going for him. He's going to be a doctor, and doctors tend to stay put. He may not be jumping around from city to city. So that calculus may work well for him, but we have to keep in mind for a lot of workers, let's say you're a blue-collar worker who wants to get a job in North Dakota, you may need to pick up and move, or you could be a high-tech worker. Are you going to get a job in Boston, or is it going to be Austin or San Francisco? You want to maintain that mobility that comes with just renting a house. So there are a lot of people who are pretty happy with the idea of continuing to rent.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about what to expect from the housing market in 2012 with NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn Giwax. Marilyn, here's another comment posted on Facebook, this one from Wendy North of Montclair, New Jersey. Wendy and her family moved to a rental home there from Portland, Oregon, when her husband lost her job in Portland. And then they moved, just like you were talking about just now, for a better opportunity on the East Coast. Here's what she had to say.
Renting doesn't feel so bad. It's nice to feel like we have the freedom to get up and go if we have to, and it's also nice to know that when something goes wrong, it's not our responsibility to fix it. So initially, I kicked and fought and hated having to hear neighbors and share a yard, but honestly, those neighbors have watched the kids, bought them Christmas presents, and ended up being friends. So So we've learned to keep what we need and love and get rid of the rest because we don't have time for the nonsense or room for it. And ultimately, this sums up our new life. So we're letting the Joneses stress about house upkeep while we go to the park and play.
Well, go, Wendy. Well, thanks for coming in from the park long enough to write to us. Marilyn, what do you think about that? This is an interesting perspective. This is also something you talked about earlier.
So this is the dilemma that a lot of people face. On the one hand, there's a lot to be said for renting. Other people feel like rents are too high. It's time to move. But here was one comment I liked. Someone wrote in on Facebook and said, "My husband and I have been renters since leaving our parents' home 9 years ago. We love the freedom of renting, but now that we have a daughter, we're thinking about buying a home." So here we are in 2012, and this is what realtors and mortgage brokers and the home builders are hoping, is that deep down, still there's an awful lot of people who have that desire to own a home, and they want to get into the housing market. Now, there are some negatives. There's some reasons to be worried. Unemployment is still high. Credit scores are a problem. But if we start to see price stability, more people like this renter will say, "I've got a daughter on the way. I want to buy a house. We're going to move back into the market."
But I have to ask you, though, no disrespect to this person who wrote in, but isn't that emotional as opposed to financial?
Yeah,
is the desire to buy a home, I mean, how much of that has been caught up in the emotion that has been created by whatever factors as opposed to the financial realities and then, or government policy? Or financial policy, which has pushed people into home ownership, whether or not it was appropriate for them. I mean,
you know, there's a reason we call it the American dream. It isn't necessarily smart financial calculus. There is a part of it that is kind of making your wishes come true. For some people, no matter what the economics are, they have a desire to own a home. It's just the way people would like to live. So right now, we're kind of on that knife's edge where a lot of people have been renting. They've gotten used to it. It's the new normal for them, and they want to stay renters. And other people start feeling that tug of the American dream where the emotion comes out and they just want their own home.
Except that policy has played a role in this, hasn't it, Marilyn? I mean,
yes.
For the fact of, for example, for, you know, perhaps immigrants coming from countries where they were discriminated against in home ownership. For African Americans, for example, there are parts of this country where you could not vote unless you were a homeowner or you were a property owner. So that effectively disenfranchised, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. I mean, haven't there been policies that have pushed people into home ownership?
Right. There are both policies. Certainly the biggest policy is probably the interest rate deductibility. But there are reasons why we have policies that allow people to buy homes and try to encourage that. And that's because we know that most Americans, most of the time, do like to own a home. So we're going to have to see going into 2012, will people stick with the let's rent or will they start getting back into that mood to buy? And one of the things you have to see for people to really move into home ownership again is price stability. Nobody wants to buy a house when the price is falling. So how do we achieve this stability this year? One thing is that sellers have to really capitulate. They have to admit that actually prices are down by about a third from what they used to be. And once you accept the fact that the price is lower and you put the sign out there at a reasonable price, buyers do start to show up.
What about the areas that have been depressed for a while? What is going to happen to the existing housing stock in those areas? You know, there are parts of the country where construction has halted on new projects that had been going forward, and that there are, because of the foreclosure issue, for reasons of unemployment, where there is existing housing stock that is vacant. What is likely to happen in those areas?
You know, before 5 years ago, the sound you would often hear around this country is hammers and nails and saws as houses were being built. Lately, what you've been hearing is bulldozers knocking down a lot of those foreclosed houses. The fact is that houses, if they sit and sit and sit, they become kind of worthless. So we're seeing in places like Detroit, in Cleveland, in lots of places around the country in the Rust Belt where houses are just being knocked down. The cities are rounding up money to eliminate eyesores and dangers. But it's also the Sun Belt. There are places in Las Vegas, Phoenix, California, where entire subdivisions are basically going back to nature because we have to admit that some of those houses were just They've just been vacant too long, and no one is ever going to move in. So there's sort of capitulation in that sense, too, where we're just scraping it clean and starting over.
What about all these policies that have been so much advertised? When you see billboards in many cities saying, if you're in trouble, call us now. There have been various initiatives by state governments, by the federal government, to assist people who are on the verge of foreclosure if they weren't there already. Are any of those bearing fruit in efforts to keep people in their homes who might lose them otherwise, either by adjusting the principal that they're mm-hmm. owed, or by adjusting the interest that they're owed, or those initiatives? Are any of those bearing fruit?
Not enough so far. I mean, this has really been a key problem. One of the big frustrations for the Obama administration, for everyone really, has been that these loan modifications haven't gone forward very well. A lot of it just is paperwork messes. So what another thing people are hoping for is that in 2012 we'll finally really get moving on these modifications and lower those interest rates, and in many cases even cut the principal, which is a really radical thought, but to get those mortgage payments down so that we can clean up some of this foreclosure mess.
And Marilyn, final thought from you. We only have about a minute left. If you were in a position to, financially, you're in a position to afford to buy a home, is there an ideal homeowner? Is there a person for whom you would say, yes, you are the person who should buy a home at this stage of your life for whatever reason? And is there a rule of thumb you would follow in choosing a home at this stage?
Yes, I think that the one thing that people really have to look for is not flip this house mentality, that the person who should buy a house is not somebody who's jumping from city to city pursuing a higher paying job, but someone who really is where they want to be, and their timeline is more like 10 years. So if you're looking at a place where your kids are starting school, you want to settle in, you want a community, you want that backyard, hey, this is a great time to start to look to buy. But if you're just 24 years old and you're not sure what city you want to be in, maybe it's a better time for labor mobility.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax was kind enough to join us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Marilyn, thank you so much for joining us. And Happy New Year once again.
You're welcome. It's always fun to be here. Thank you.
Coming up, let's go from the big picture of the country's economy to the small picture of personal finances. But how do you start? Do you start with the rent, a big credit card bill, paying off the car note? We'll speak with a frugalista about getting our money in order in 2012. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
The big bowls are underway. The five games in the bowl championship series stand out in the crowded college football postseason. They command the largest national television audience and pay out the most money. They also generate the most controversy, although yesterday the first two BCS bowl games generally created nothing but thrills. Oregon beat Wisconsin 45-38 in the Rose Bowl, and Oklahoma State won a 41-38 nail-biter over Stanford in the Fiesta Bowl. NPR's Tom Goldman joins us with more. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Linda.
Let's start with the nightcap. The Fiesta Bowl in Arizona was supposed to be Stanford quarterback Andrew Luck's last chance to shine before he headed off to become the number one draft pick in the NFL. So did he shine?
Pretty much. He only misfired on four passes. He completed 27 of 31 for two touchdowns. So, yeah, he was good. But, you know, he was upstaged pretty much by Oklahoma State quarterback Brandon Weeden. That's 28-year-old Brandon Weeden. Old man Weeden led his team to a big win last night. He threw for 399 yards, three touchdowns, and the big pass at the end that set up the Cowboys' short winning field goal in overtime. Still, Linda, Luck would have gone out a winner if Stanford kicker Jordan Williamson didn't blow two makeable field goals. One, a 35-yarder as regulation time ended, and then a 43-yarder in overtime. And he reportedly was sobbing in front of his locker after the game and didn't speak with reporters.
Poor guy.
Yeah.
So, Tom, Oregon has been one of the country's most exciting teams in recent years, not to mention college football's fashion trendsetter with its uniforms and mirrored helmets yesterday.
Yeah.
But no bowl game victories, and that has finally changed, of course. So how did the Ducks break through against Wisconsin?
Well, you know, of course, there were the Oregon pyrotechnics we're all used to. My favorite stat of the day, Oregon's DeAnthony Thomas scored on runs of 91 and 64 yards. Those were his only two runs of the game for 155 yards. That means he had a 77.5 yard per carry average. Now, that kind of explosive run-oriented offense has defined Oregon, but their defense came through at key moments. The passing game was key. Oregon quarterback Darren Thomas and wide receiver Lavoisier Tuine hooked up for two touchdowns, but also some key first downs to keep the Ducks moving down the field. So it was a big breakthrough win for Oregon, which narrowly lost in the national championship game last season.
Now, the recent scandals at Penn State and before that Miami and Ohio State seem to sort of silence the annual criticism of the bowl championship series. But are you seeing any reason for BCS haters still to hate?
Oh, sure. The biggest criticism, the BCS uses polls and computers to match up teams in these five games instead of having a playoff. That criticism still applies. You look at yesterday's games, all four very good teams played well, could have been part of an entertaining playoff. The other criticism was the selection of teams for this year's BCS games. Tonight's Sugar Bowl in particular, number 11 Virginia Tech versus number 13 Michigan. When top 10 ranked teams like Boise State and Kansas State didn't get into a lucrative BCS bowl, you know, it just leaves critics confused about how teams are selected for these big games, although there is consensus, as there usually is, that the teams chosen for the national championship game, that would be this year LSU and Alabama next week, is fairly commendable.
Okay. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
The filmmaker Mike Mills is accustomed to sharing personal details with a large audience. Mills directed the movie Beginners. It's based on Mills' real-life experience of having a father who came out of the closet at the age of 75. Beginners stars Ewan McGregor and Christopher Plummer.
My parents got married in 1955. They had a child, and they stayed married for 44 years until my mother died. 6 months later, my father told me he was gay.
I'm gay.
I remember him wearing a purple sweater when he told me this, but actually he wore a robe.
I'm gay.
He was gay the whole time they were married.
Mike Mills joined us for the latest installment of our series, Watch This. We get movie picks from people in the industry. First on Mills' list is The Thin Blue Line, an Errol Morris documentary from 1988.
This is the film that actually got me into filmmaking. It's an amazing documentary about a man who was put in prison for supposedly murdering another man. And the film actually got this man out of jail eventually. And Errol Morris, you know, he started off as a private detective. Did you know that?
No.
And his films are very much the mind of a detective. What's amazing about this film is that it's going to sound a little bit like cheesy reenactments. But he goes through interviewing all the witnesses, interviewing everybody involved in the case, and then often you'll see their description of the car that the man was driving in or what the police did when they arrived on the scene. So there's this amazing scene where supposedly one of the cops got out of the police car and a shot was fired and the woman was drinking a milkshake and she threw the milkshake. And throughout the film, you see this milkshake being thrown in all different versions, everybody's different version of the story of how the milkshake was thrown, where it landed, what it meant that she had a milkshake. So while it's a documentary, while it's about real things, it's a really beautiful meditation and a study of how subjective reality is, how sort of magical and slippery reality is.
And you can see how you could use as a filmmaker a technique like that to try to get somebody out of prison, because the audience ends up asking, if people can't even agree on how a milkshake was thrown, how can they agree on the guilt or innocence of somebody?
Oh, in his, that film had a real aha moment where he actually got a confession out of the man who actually did murder the other man.
Now let's go from that crime to another one with a rather dramatic title here, Shoot the Piano Player.
Truffaut's gorgeous second film.
Explain who Truffaut is.
François Truffaut is one of the, you know, him and Godard are sort of the two most famous French New Wave guys, and they, you know, started working in the late 50s, early 60s. This film, it's really in the guise of being sort of a noir film, but then he constantly derails it, and there's all this irreverent humor in it, very just sort of wacky, funny moments, very tender moments.
So it's kind of, it's deconstructing film noir.
Yeah, but back in, I think it's made in like 60. You know, that's way before we were ever using this word deconstructed. He's taking this format, noir, and making it suit his needs, what he nailed, the sort of emotional story that he needed to tell, the humor that he needed to have to be more free, to sort of break open from all this kind of serious macho men in Bogartian hats and jackets.
Bogartian hats. I hope you've copyrighted that.
You know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. I'd love to have a hat like that.
Yeah,
it's great. It's great. Let's go right on to a Bogart movie that's on your list here. This is a great one. It's a great one to watch. I think we could argue about whether it's a great movie, but it's To Have and Have Not, a Howard Hawks film with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall.
If I was inviting you all to dinner and a movie tonight, I would do maybe a double feature with starting off with To Have and Have Not and then going to Shoot the Piano Player, because they do relate to each other. And I guess my mother adored Humphrey Bogart. I grew up with my mother saying, in my next life, I'm going to marry Humphrey Bogart just about every day. And I, love him myself. And that film really is like Casablanca Part 2. It's all the same characters. It's really riding off the coattails of Casablanca.
It's a rewrite of Casablanca.
Yeah, yes.
This is the same situation, but on a Caribbean island.
Yes, exactly. It's Warner going, how can we just make more money with all these same elements and just slip them around just a little bit? But Casablanca has more of a dramatic tone. To Have and Have Not has amazing, really snappy dialogue between Bacall and Bogart. And of course, this is the film where they met and in real life fell in love. And the dialogue, which was written a lot by Howard Hawks, is a lot of the banter between him and his real wife, who was also nicknamed Slim, as Lauren Bacall is in the film. So to me, I think there's a lot of zhuzhy excitement that I think comes from these real things.
I'm sorry, Slim. But I still say you're awful good, and I wouldn't...
Oh, I forgot. You wouldn't take anything from anybody, would you?
That's right.
You know, Steve, you're not very hard to figure. Only at times. Sometimes I know exactly what you're going to say. Most of the time. The other times, you're just a stinker.
So this is something you'd be happy to show at home. I mean,
I adore watching that movie. I watch it all the time. There's some movies I watch, they're kind of like my anti-anxiety pill, my antidepressant pill. I watch them at least once or twice a month, probably. And I never stop learning from them as a filmmaker.
Now, what about A Woman is a Woman from 1961, another movie on your list here of, of recommended viewing?
So clearly I'm a very pretentious French New Wave buff.
second choice from that era. Yeah.
I love that French early 60s stuff. All those films are trying so hard to reinvent film, to not follow the rules. And I love that energy. A Woman is a Woman is sort of like a musical, but not. The sound is constantly going on and off in the film. If you haven't seen it before and you watch it, you're going to think something's wrong with your DVD player. And to me, that's wildly exciting. That's Godard making us more conscious of how music affects storytelling, music affects the film.
On se demande pourquoi tout le monde est fou de moi. Ce n'est pas compliqué. Voilà la vérité.
I guess I watch movies to make myself happier a lot. And this film has such... it's not an easy film. It's not a happy-go-lucky film. But there's such a reaching out for happiness, for fun, for making the world as you want it to be, not as the boring, bad, unlife-affirming rules tell you it should be.
Well, Mike Mills, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Watch This, from director Mike Mills, speaking to us from our studios at NPR West. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Turning back to the economy now to matters of personal finance. It's a new year, and that's a time when many people make resolutions and lay out goals. But with the economy still struggling, a lot of people are struggling to keep their budgets in order. Here to help us out is Natalie McNeil. She is the author of the book, The Frugalista Files. It chronicles her journey from spending money on all kinds of stuff to setting a strict budget and getting out of $20,000 in debt in just 2 years. Welcome to the program, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me, Michelle.
And Natalie, you're very focused in your both in your blog and in your book on the single divas like yourself.
Yes.
I mean, we're going to talk to parents later about setting limits with their kids. So I just want to emphasize this is not your particular thing. So when somebody says, I need to get my finances together, that's the kind of thing many people say to themselves. It can sound like such a big task. Do you have a good tip for getting started, kind of breaking it down into something smaller and doable?
Absolutely, because people get overwhelmed with budgets and think they have to do a lot of spreadsheets. All you have to do is, at the beginning of the year, add up all of your debts, your credit card debts, student loans, even if they're in forbearance or deferred. Add up all of your debts, you know, your credit card balances, interest, and then also add up all of your expenses in terms of rent, mortgage, dry cleaning bills, and then add up your after-tax income. And if you find out that you have more expenses and debts than you have money coming in, then you really have to make some serious changes with your budget and look at places to cut back, as well as ways you can earn more money to give your bank account a rest.
Now, you said that you got out of $20,000 in debt in just 2 years. A lot of people might say, look, my hours have been cut at work. I just can't do that.
No, absolutely. But you have to look at it. If your hours have been cut, that means you have more time to look for freelance work or other opportunities, or to pursue things that you really enjoy, or invest in yourself. The Frugalista plan is to cut back expenses, earn more cash, invest in yourself, and take a risk. So if that means that you have to take some classes that'll make you more valuable to your employer or other employers, then use that time to do that right now. So just because they're cutting back your hours doesn't have to mean it's a bad thing. It's a way for you to actually be able to earn more money because you have more free time.
You know, you talk about the need to pamper your finances just the way you pamper anything else that you care about in life. And you say that you should be spending at least an hour a week, and preferably three, on pampering your finances. What do you
Absolutely.
Mean by that?
Absolutely, because it's a lifestyle. You know, when you're thinking about personal finance, it's highly personal. You can't get to a great retirement and great investments if you're spending all your money getting your hair done, getting your mani-pedis done, and you don't have enough income to support that lifestyle. So while you're going out taking care of yourself, you have to take care of your bank account, because it will take care of you in the long term. So it's all interconnected. And I always say that. So if that means that you don't have a stressed out account, that you're, you know, being a promiscuous spender and always taking out money, and you have a nice, fat, cushy banking account, that's just as good as, you know, getting a massage at the parlor. Massage everything.
You know,
massage
it all. One of the things you did when you were getting your finances in order was to institute a no-buy month. And I will note that this is one of the things that I think a number of religious institutions have instituted for their congregants at different points of year. They'll say things like, go on a financial fast instead of a food fast, or along with a food fast. What did you do, and how did you go about doing it?
I mean, I did the no-buy month. It's how I became a Frugalista. It changed my life. I do it in February every year, and I go a month without getting my hair done, nails done. I don't dine out. I don't do any discretionary spending, including I don't pay to go to the movies. You know, I don't go to vending machines. Even 25 cents for some gum at a gumball machine is not acceptable. I pay my bills. You know, if I have like a car issue because I need transportation for my job, of course, I'll get that handled, but nothing discretionary. But during that time, you learn to look at your bank account. Everyone's like, oh, I'm paycheck to paycheck. A lot of people are like that. You realize that your bank account stabilizes, and that's why I say pampering your finances. Learn what it's like to have a bank account that's not always dwindling. And after doing that, it's like a light bulb goes up and your survivor instincts kick in. And when you're always saying, oh, I don't have any clothes to wear, you find clothes in your closet and you get really creative. Or when you're always telling yourself, oh, I can't do my hair, you'll find a new style. And even if it means you wear your hair back in a bun and everyone at work is like, oh, wow, you look really nice. I see your eyes. You just try different things. So I mean, all these things have happened to me when I did No Buy Month. And you have to have fun. And, you know, the Frugalista plan is also living fabulous, the frugal side of fabulous. So find some free concerts in town, you know, rent a DVD from the library, you know, not even renting, you know, borrow a DVD from the library. Find some things that you can do that are low cost, I mean, no cost during that month. And, you know, you'll see that, okay, if I could do this for, you know, 28, 29 days in February, what else can I conquer for the rest of the year?
Natalie, you know, it did not go without notice that you picked the shortest month in the year, okay?
and it's close to January, too. That's why. That's what I tell people. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, in the beginning, it's fun because, you know, we blog about it. It's a real community. You know, get online and do it so you don't have to be alone and you can share tips. But, yeah, toward the 28th, 29th month, it's 28th day. It's a little bit tough, but it's doable. I still have all my fingers and toes, and I've done it, like, over three times.
Now, do you find that telling people you're doing this helps you
to
keep at it?
Oh, absolutely. I blog about all of this stuff because it's a community building. You reinforce each other.
Well, that's actually why you started doing it, isn't it? Isn't that why you started blogging?
Absolutely.
Because you wanted to be held accountable by people
Exactly. I had all this stuff that I was dealing with. I had no plan to get rid of it. And so if I told everyone and everybody was watching me do this challenge, and some people actually joined in, then I knew that I didn't want to let everyone down, because other times I tried to get my budget in order and it just didn't work out. So I had to take it public. And, you know, I love the results. And right now, you know, that was like in 2008 when I started. Now everybody's into personal finance. It's really sexy right now. So I have people on Twitter I'm tweeting back and forth with. I have like a whole crew starting to do it by month in February. And, you know, if the worst thing someone tells you to do is just like take care of your money and find other ways to have fun, I think that's a good thing.
Well, you say one of the things you say in your top 10 Frugalista tips is coupons are sexy.
Absolutely.
Coupons are sexy. Okay, but single diva. Now, if a guy took you out on a date with a coupon, I'm sorry, I have to wonder whether they would be date number two.
We talked about this on the blog because I have a Frugalista who posts for me and he's a big couponer. I say the first 3 dates, I prefer no. Then afterward, that's great. You know, I like to be a little bit wine and dined, or you can find creative things to do. Like, I'm okay with going to a jog or a walk in a park. We don't have to have an expensive date, but I don't want to be Groupon, you know, daily deal dependent about what going out for a social life. You know what I mean? Like, let's not bring the outside world into what we're trying to create. So I prefer the first 3 dates. But a lot of women, especially the younger generation, the college kids, they're like, you know, the food tastes just the same, whether or not it's with a daily deal or not.
Bring the coupon.
To each your own.
All right.
Bring it.
All right. Bring the coupon. So, okay. Well, we'll check back with you later in the year to see how the Frugalista is making it in the spring when the, you know, spring is in the air. How about that?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Natalie McNeil is a blogger and author of the book, The Frugalista Files, and she was kind enough to join us from member station WLRN in Miami. Happy New Year, Natalie.
Happy New Year.
Just ahead, a pair of basketball shoes caused a frenzy this holiday season.
11 Concourse exclusive. You see what I'm saying?
I ain't been out in 11 years.
Those shoppers are talking about the new Nike Air Jordan sneakers that retail for $180 a pair and can go for even more online. So what do you do when your child wants a pair? Our panel of parents on when they cave on the brand names and when they draw the line. And we'll hear from a marketing professor about why we care so much about labels to begin with. That conversation is just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.